I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, and welcome to Cinematic Universe, the podcast that is all about... No, it's not. It's not about comic book movies anymore. Now it's just about whatever we want to talk about. And today, I'm Joe Cunningham, and I'm joined with... by... Keep going.
James Hunt.
Reese Williamson.
And Caroline Sita.
See, it all came together. It's like a flawless Broadway production.
You guys, I don't think I've done a podcast in a full year, so I apologize in advance if all of my skills have left me.
I think I did one of the last ones with you, Caroline.
Yeah, I think you did.
We did
Lord of the Rings.
Lord of the Rings, yeah. Listeners, Caroline is joining us today. So, Caroline, we can explain the new format to you and to our listeners at the same time. So, we've got rid of all of the comic book movie stuff. We've pushed that over to Patreon, and that's where you find that stuff, such as our scintillating discussion of Madame Web, where it was pointed out to me by a friend that we forgot to do any kind of spoiler-free section or any kind of context or building, and we just went straight into what the fuck was that? And on this feed, we talk a little bit about the things we've been watching, a little bit about some movie news, and then we just talk about someone's pick that week. So we talked about Poor Things and Reds. And,
of course, Reds.
And what was your film called, James?
Shortcomings.
Yeah, I remember it well. And Caroline, as our first guest in this new format, you have picked the subject matter for this week's show. So just want to quickly tee us up now what you've picked and kind of why you picked it.
Yeah, well, I decided, you know what? Why is a great question. I don't know why this came to me. In fact, it's a name of a song in the musical. It is the musical Tick, Tick, Boom. 2021, so really recent, directed by Lin-Manuel Miranda, starring Andrew Garfield. So I figured I'm sort of taking a leap by taking you guys in the musical direction, but we've got a Spider-Man actor in the lead, so I was hoping that could be a sort of comforting transition point. But honestly, more so, I just think this movie is really good, and I think it was appreciated when it came out, but I don't know, 2021 was a weird year, and so I think a lot of things from that year are also kind of forgotten, and I felt like this one deserved a little more shine now that we're a few years out, so I'm excited, and I am very excited to see what you guys thought of it.
I was not surprised that you picked it. It felt like a very Caroline pick.
Yeah, I would agree. Yeah. That's why I picked it.
Yeah, definitely looking forward to talking about it. I think we figured out, haven't we, that so the first movie we watched in this new format, the leads were Gwen Stacy and The Incredible Hulk.
Oh, sure.
The second movie was directed by the star of the Aquaman and Ant-Man franchises.
Mm-hmm.
The third one starred Dick Tracy, and then, yeah, today, Spider-Man and Storm.
Yeah, I was thinking of that too.
Leading this one.
Our most beloved take on Storm.
We all remember it. But yeah, we will get to Tick, Tick, Boom in a little bit. We'll start off with what we've been watching. I'll just throw it open. Who's most excited to get going with what they've been watching? Anything exciting?
I'm going to go first. Ooh. Because... I saw the UK production of Hades Town.
Ooh,
Now, I saw... it's another musical, so it's on theme for the podcast. Yeah. I saw Hadestown when I went to New York about a year and a half ago.
Humble brag,
yeah. I go on holiday sometimes. And, like, I didn't know anything about it. My girlfriend was like, we have to see this.
Humble brag.
The album. Yeah. Got a girlfriend too. It's all happening for James.
Someone hasn't pursued a career in the entertainment industry.
But yeah, I loved it. That cast is the original cast. And we were right up in the gods, like it was 20 quid seats or something. And when it came to the UK, I was like, okay, I'm gonna do a first for me and see a musical from the stalls. So spending a lot of money on tickets. But I can honestly say it was worth it. Like, being able to see a musical and see actors' faces, it's like a transformative experience. Because,
yeah.
Like, you're so much closer to the action and, you know, the emotions are so much more... So they're more heightened. Because it is, like... is suddenly like you're watching an actual play as opposed to watching people sort of perform at a distance. So yeah, I thought I would talk about how good that was. The UK cast, I think they're still quite fresh, probably not as polished as the American one. There are some good choices in there. Like, everyone is singing in their own accent. So some people English, some people Irish, the narrator is Jamaican. So that brings it a completely different texture, but something that is more authentically, you know, sort of London, which I really liked. It's a different spin on it. The reviews of it are weird. Like, a lot of people are saying, oh, everyone loves Hadestown, but I don't get it, 2 stars. And the people who love it are saying, like, amazing as ever, 5 stars. So, you know, if
for,
I was to
for
recommend...
For someone who's only familiar with Hadestown as a title, could you give me a brief little...
It's the story of Orpheus and Eurydice done in a kind of New Orleans jazz style, Depression-era jazz style. It's fucking great. I loved it. I loved it the first time. I loved it the second time. And if you're in London or New York, or can get to either, I would heartily recommend seeing it.
Caroline,
and just going blind
your,
as well.
From the noises you were making there, are you familiar with Hadestown?
I am, yeah. I saw it on Broadway as well, and I really liked it. It's in a like a folk, more of a folk music style than like a musical theater sound. So it's not that like classic jazz hand Broadway experience, which I think can be great, like as an intro for people, you know, who maybe musicals aren't traditionally their thing. I think for me, it was such a cool like experience. Some of the staging is really incredible. They do this act one big climactic number with these like lights swinging around, and it's so good. It's a little abstract at times, I think, because they're working with the fable, and it's like some of the music is a little more about vibe than storytelling, I would say. So like for 100%. Me, it's not like a top tier favorite, but like a really very cool experience that I would also recommend for just about anybody.
Yeah, that was one of the things I thought about, actually, is that it, when you're watching it, especially when you're up close, it plays more like watching a gig than watching a musical, because it's a sort of, it's like a 2-hour long musical experience.
Yeah,
the story is pretty thin, and yeah, they skip quite large sections of story in, you know, service of getting to the emotional beats. So, you know, it's interesting in that regard. But I think, yeah, as an experience, it's great.
I've seen a musical on stage for ages.
I actually saw it in London in 2018 before it went to
Broadway. Oh, the first production.
Yeah, that's right. But it's funny, it's not that I'd forgotten about it, but it wasn't like Hamilton or other musicals where it then really just became part of my personality for a few months. I saw it, I liked it, I forgot about it. But then actually when this, you know, when it was kind of coming back to London, and I, you know, I hadn't really thought about it much since, I can remember a lot of the scenes and the staging and even the songs from that original production, which is 6 years ago, and that I think that just shows staying power. And like I remember, there's that beat at the end where, you know, not, I mean, I won't spoil the myth, I guess, or the show, but the the emotional climax really of the romance. It's, I mean, I can remember that moment like I saw it yesterday, which and my memory, I can barely remember what I did yesterday. so I guess that's about as good a review as I can give something.
And how far back were you sitting?
It was the National Theatre, the Dorfman. I was pretty far back. Those tickets were cheap. We might have even got them on Rush. They might have even cost, sorry, James, it might have even cost £10. sorry to tell you, but yes, went to my friend. It was great, and so yeah, we're three quarters Hadestowns viewers here, so that was pretty good.
Maybe
this podcast should maybe just become about musical theater. I don't know. Maybe
okay. Then welcome to my new podcast. I'm now the host of.
James, have you got anything else?
Yeah, I mean, I can keep going, but there are two things that I want to mention. Actually, I'll do three things quickly. I saw Bottoms, which I hadn't seen when it came out. Caught up with that. Really good fun. First time I've seen a film and gone like, oh, this feels like a sort of Gen Z film. Like this is mm-hmm, the next. Yeah, this is like the next thing. Much funnier than I was primed to expect. So that's on Amazon Prime. And worth looking up.
Yeah, I think we talked about it when I watched it, didn't we? But I'm so keen to revisit that and just be ready for its vibe from minute one, rather than kind of figuring out like half an hour in, like, oh no, it's completely in this like fantasy world.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, that was good and is available easily, so I won't go on too much about it. Also, I went to the cinema to see Late Night with the Devil, a horror movie starring David Dasmalchian. Very good. It's been overshadowed somewhat by the fact that there are three stills in it which use AI art. And a lot of people are saying, I'm not going to see that film because it used AI. And like, it's tough.
And what's the context of that? Sorry.
The context of the film is that it's supposed to be like a studio tape of a 70s talk show where sort of occult things are going on. Like it's a Halloween episode. And they've used, within the show, they've used AI art for some of the ad bumpers. So the show is called Night Owls, and it will come up and it will say Night Owls, and there's a skeleton who's got like a jack-o'-lantern and stuff. But if you look closely, you can tell like, oh, this was done using like Midjourney or something. And it's a real shame because the film is great. David Dasmalchian is such a magnetic performance, and it has to be because the camera's on him for like an hour and a half. And he goes through everything in it. He's funny, he's charming, he's like terrifying when he needs to be, and like just all that stuff. I wish they hadn't put the AI art in it, because now it's all people are talking about.
How do we feel about that? Except like,
well, I'll
I
tell guess you...
I kind of feel like it, low budget filmmaking is always looking for areas to
the amount of work they're talking about. It would have been like 300 quid's worth of money. Like, it's not a realistic amount of money to save. I think charitably, the film was shot, you know, close to 2 years ago now. Probably the conversation around AI has moved on significantly since then. I don't think they would do it again now. I think the people who are saying, oh, you know, simply recut the movie, are perhaps being a bit too optimistic about the, you know, the process that's involved in that sort of thing, especially on the low budget end of filmmaking. I hope the lesson from this is don't use AI tools in your low budget movie.
That won't be the lesson, James.
Yeah.
I have to tell you, so, it'll just be hide it better.
I think great film, but be aware of that going into it and make your decision from an informed place.
I didn't think we were there yet with AI in art as a conversation, but maybe we are. Like, it's sort of, you might be cancelled if you use AI in your stuff. Maybe we're there. I'm not saying I'm against that or pro that, but maybe we're there.
A lot of people are saying, it's okay to pirate this movie because they used AI art, which I think is overstating it massively.
If I were the filmmakers, I would just say, that's actually in story, that the devil has put that in there. The devil has invaded.
Midjourney didn't exist in the 1970s, did it? Yeah.
If you're Satan, you can time travel, bro. I'm just trying to defend that.
Yeah, but no, it's a good movie. Unlike the final thing we're going to mention, which is Ghostbusters Frozen Empire. Mm.
Snowy Ghostbusters.
Yeah, I mean, not for three quarters of it. They take a long time to get to the frozen bit.
You were too generous on your Letterboxd review of this, James. I'm sorry, you were too fucking generous, my friend.
What, with my two-star review?
This movie stinks! No!
Well... You go on then, Reese. You tell us what you thought.
I really hated it, and I hated the first one. I don't know why I was there. I was there opening day. I guess my life stinks. I got nothing better to do. Me and my friend went to see it. At least we didn't pay for it because he runs the cinema fine. I just hated this. Really hated it. It wasn't anything, and then it just ended. It has all the nostalgia. Bullshit.
It wasn't anything, and then it just ended. It's the funniest film review I've ever heard. I love that.
The kind of plot, the story doesn't even happen until the end, and then it ends, and then it happens, and then it ends. Dan Aykroyd looked way too happy to be there and for the movie to exist. Bill Murray looks anything but. All the kind of, Walter Peck's back, do it, like somehow he's the mayor again. Fine, I guess I don't need to explain that, but that's just to push a nostalgia button. I hated it. I found nothing to like about it. Nothing, zero.
Did you like the last one?
It wasn't fun. No, I'm saying I hated the last one. I hate the same. I'm not sure. I mean, I guess I didn't hate this one anymore. And James Acaster as well. I just want to slight Acaster corner, which is, just why have you done this, man? Like, why, you have this, you have a proper kind of thriving UK stand-up career, I just don't. He doesn't have a single laugh line in this movie, and he doesn't have any dramatic stuff either, so very strange decision from him, bad decision from him.
Do you have much awareness of James Acaster, Caroline?
Nope.
He's a British comedian who roundly well liked, right? Everyone kind of pro.
He's considered one of the greatest comedians of his generation. He's got a bunch of specials on Netflix.
Yeah, and he's got a very successful podcast, which is probably where most of his income comes from.
The Off Menu podcast, yeah,
more so even than starring in Ghostbusters: Frozen Empire. But it was a real one. It was one of those like when the trailer for that came out, and there was like in the first trailer there was like one shot of him. And I think everyone collectively in this country did a double take and went, "You what? What's he doing there?"
Well, I don't know if any of you guys have watched Three Body Problem, but there's a lot of UK comedians in that too. Phil Wang turns up in it. I was like, "Wait a second."
Oh, we'll get to that. We'll get to Three Body.
Okay,
Hold on.
Hold fine.
I haven't watched Three Hold Body fine. Problem because I think it has a two creator problem.
Okay, hold on, guys. I've said hold on.
We'll get to it.
You done, James? Oh no, he's not.
I just want to talk about Ghostbusters a little bit more. I did the one thing I think in it that is actually quite good is Phoebe has this kind of sort of friendship / it's a bit queer baity actually relationship with a female ghost. I thought that was good. I thought she carried it well. I thought the writing on it was good and got to where it needed to be. That should have been the movie, probably. Everyone else just sort of there. Stranger Things kid, no point for him being there. Gets about three scenes with Slimer. That's that box ticked, I guess.
How's podcast?
Podcast is there. Does some stuff in the middle acts that was clearly is clearly going to factor into the conclusion and then got cut. He records a very important piece of audio and then doesn't ever come up again.
Listen, every podcaster has recorded some important audio that's never come up again.
Yeah, it's not good. I did see it in 4DX though, so it was a very
whoa. Did you get frozen?
We didn't. Sadly.
You get slimed?
Sadly not. No slime, no freezing.
Just that's terrible.
That's the point.
The sensation of being kicked in the back of the chair for two hours.
I heard that too.
Stalls 4DX. This guy's living the life.
You'd think our Patreon money was going up.
Okay, I am done now. I'm done.
Reese, do you want to go? Because you sounded like you're chomping at the bit.
Yes, three body problem. That's what I want to talk about. So good. So good. Anyone else watched it at all? Any of it?
I'm four.
No, but it's on my list.
Four episodes in.
Oh,
so no spoilers.
I love this. I did the bonge. I did the whole bonge last weekend. I had like one friend that was watching. We were texting. It just felt like just my memory of, you know, when I talk about Ghostbusters, Frozen Empire, like not scratching any kind of nostalgia itch. This scratch proper Battlestar Lost.
That's what I got. Yeah.
Not in terms of the, not maybe necessarily in terms of what the show is, right? Very different shows, but the experience of watching it episode to episode, talking about it with my buddy who's watching at the same time. For those who don't, but you know, it already feels like a bit of a dream. This last weekend I had, or I guess was it 2 weekends? I can't remember now. No, last weekend, a dream of watching Three Body Problem across the 2 days. So much fun. For those who don't know, I mean, you know, the basic premise is you kind of meet five friends who go to Oxford, who went to Oxford Uni, and they're into different worlds of science and physics, and one has become a teacher, but they're sort of in high level sciencey jobs, I guess, in the UK. And you kind of meet them, and they start to interact with these mysterious murders that are happening in the wider scientific community across the world. And you meet Benedict Wong, murders and suicides. You meet Benedict Wong, who's a detective of a nondescript government or intra-government body, and he's investigating the murders. And then there's this sort of strange, you could describe it as like a VR headset that transports the players into a strange world, kind of is there, but it's quite mysterious. And, you know, it's about aliens eventually, you know, that isn't a spoiler, that is the premise, but some of the reveals, some of the way the story is parceled out, and it's based on this China, you know, sort of hard sci-fi, very apparently very dense novel from about a decade ago, and the adaptation's quite, from what I understand, quite ambitious, you know, sort of basically the whole original novel is set in China with a single Chinese character as the one who's sort of, you know, unpicking this mystery. And then DB and Benioff and Weiss, the Game of Thrones guys, plus Alexander Wu is the other, I don't know if that's the other creator you're referencing, Joe, but they have taken a single Chinese character.
Benioff and Weiss.
Fine, I hear you. Well, you missed then the third creator problem. They could take that one character and essentially sort of split him into five characters, this Oxford group that I was mentioning, which is quite an ambitious adaptation move, to be honest. But it kind of works. I think if I have one comment about the show, you know, after having watched the first season, is that it ends up basically being this an insane coincidence that these five essentially university friends happen to be very involved in this big global sort of alien conspiracy storyline. And of course that isn't true in the original novel because it wasn't five guys, it was one.
It was just one, yeah.
So that's that, you see that a bit, but it's just so well, it's so well adapted, it's so well
it's really together. Gripping, the big moments to moment.
Yeah, it's really gripping, the big moments really hit, the ideas are, you know, the ideas, which is why the book hit in the first place, the ideas are there and they're really compelling. I just loved it. I haven't felt like that watching it in years, a TV show. So I loved it.
I mean, the sort of big ideas of it is what reminded me of Lost. Like, they chuck so much in there. And the mystery is always unraveling. There's no, like, no filler. Good characters. Everyone's got something to do that matters. It reminded me, I would say Arrival meets Lost, and that's right in my
wheelhouse. Yeah, so it's a really good shout. Yeah,
I am very happy with it, and I'm looking forward to where it goes.
Now, talk to me about the book series that it's based on. Is it complete?
Yes,
it's complete.
That's promising.
And I think what's exciting is that there's only three books. I'm thinking about reading the second book at least. But if you read, I did a little bit of spoilery wiki scrolling. I won't lie.
Of course you did. Yeah.
I did flick around on the third book, and the third book just sounds so fucking bug nuts and ginormous. And I find it fascinating to think how this gets to there. Yeah.
My friend said it was unfilmable.
I love it. Bring it on.
Exactly.
Yeah, really, really excited for that now. Really, really into that. And then I'll just do three other things quickly. I don't know if anyone's seen Perfect Days. Wim Wenders' Perfect Days. Saw that movie.
Go on.
I did.
I just loved it. It's really stuck with me since I saw it. I don't know if you've got any views on that, Caroline.
Yeah, it was great. Really, quiet and contemplative. Like, you want to be in the right mood for a sort of, like, it's a movie where nothing happens, but that is nothing. Very compelling.
Unlike Ghostbusters, for example, which is nothing happens.
Yeah, exactly.
Nothing happens, and then you are moved to tears by a guy, like, driving his van.
I wanted to see that at the Atlanta Film Festival. Is it a cleaner in Tokyo?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he cleans bathrooms.
That's the one.
And then you hear that premise and you go, oh, I guess there'll be sort of, the story will come at the end of Act 1. It doesn't. No, it just being solid. Really, that is what happens. Nothing happens.
But it's very, it's like this interesting mix of it's sort of melancholy, but it's also just sort of lovely. And it's not like, oh, he's doing this job and it's horrible and he wants to get out. It's just like, here's what his life is like. And here's some bad parts of it and here's some lovely parts of it. And it's got a really sort of like comforting tone that I didn't quite expect.
I mean, I found the final shot of his face.
Yeah, it's really good.
So profound and just a whole life. You see his whole life on his face, and you see all that stuff you're talking about, all the good, all the bad, and the main actor who won the actor award at Cannes, and I think there was. You know, he had some outside shot of getting it for getting an Oscar nom, but he barely says anything. You know, he probably has like 3 minutes of dialogue in the 2 hour film. I mean, and yet the performance is amazing because he says so much without saying anything.
Can't wait to see it. Sounds good.
I saw Roadhouse, which I thought was had some interesting shots in it, like of boats. And I saw Civil War. I've seen Civil War. I went to a sort of special screening of that.
And what side are you
on? Garland, and I'm on the side of burn it all down. blew me away. I did not have the issue with it of, oh, but why is it that Florida and California, what is it, Texas and California are on the same side? I need to understand, you know, I need a Vice article, a political article explaining the conflict. I was completely in it with the characters. And also I think Kirsten Dunst's character, who's a war photographer, does not care who's the motivations of the different sides. And that then you feel that through the way the film's told. I couldn't remember. I think this is the first film since The Hurt Locker that has so viscerally recreated a contemporary war setting. I couldn't think of a film more recent than that, and that was a while ago. So really, a real experience. Really fantastic. I think his best film. I watched all of the Garland films in the last couple of weeks. I thought it was really fantastic.
Rank the others,
but very very provocative.
Rank the others, Reese.
I'm rank the others. I guess I'd cheat. I did prefer Debs. I guess I'd put Debs above this. So I'd go, but that's a TV show. I'd go Debs, Civil War, Ex Machina, Men, Annihilation. I guess.
Whoa, Men above Annihilation.
That's wild.
I did not like
that's
it.
That's wild.
I saw that. I watched Annihilation and Men for the first time last week. And Annihilation, just not for me.
I struggled with Annihilation when I watched it. But it really stuck with me afterwards, and I'm kind of intrigued and terrified to go back and watch it, because like I think it's ultimately a movie about depression and mental illness, and I think after having gone through a degree of that, I think I would have a very different viewing experience watching that movie. Men's just bad, right?
I like the bit in Men when the guy comes out of his own butt and then he comes out of his own mouth and then he comes out of his own eye. That bit was like a whole half star extra for that scene. And that pipped it above Annihilation, I guess. That's me. That's what I've been.
And I think they created that in Midjourney.
take it down.
Caroline, what have you been watching?
Yeah, well, I don't know if listeners can hear it in my voice, but I have been sick for the past 8 days. I was traveling, came home immediately, got sick, haven't left my apartment. So I've been leaning towards like comfort viewing. And that actually started when I was on a plane ride from California back to Chicago, where I live. I think this was the best plane viewing I have ever orchestrated in my entire life, sitting there like semi-sick, but doing okay. And I did a double feature of Blackberry, which is one of those, you know, here's the real story behind the Blackberry. And then Dumb Money, which was about the GameStop stock shortage. So that genre of movie that's like, let's take a recent thing and show you how it happened, which are like so easy to watch. They're entertaining. They're not challenging. So I did both of those. It took up my entire flight. Dumb Money ended just as I was like, we were literally landing. I was like, I could not have had a better in-flight experience. I was so proud of myself. Neither of them, I think, are like, I don't know. They would not have made my best of the year list of movies, but both super entertaining for what they were. I thought Blackberry was actually really good. Blackberry was the stronger of the two for me, which is about basically like the creation of the Blackberry phone and how revolutionary that was, and then how wild it was that got overtaken by the iPhone. And it has real like social network vibes to it, I would say, and it doesn't reach that level, but is like a really entertaining step down from that sort of movie. And then Dumb Money, yeah, fun, you know. I don't know. They did GameStop stock something. It was just like entertaining and not challenging, and that's exactly what I want on an airplane.
I keep waiting for BlackBerry to show up on a streaming service, and it has resolutely refused to so far.
Well, you got to take an American Airlines flight, and it's right there for you.
Maybe that's
it.
Maybe
take a flight
instead of dropping £3.49 on a rental. I just need to book a flight.
Yeah, it'll be a cheaper option.
Has anyone seen? Sorry, go on.
I was going to say you already have the perfect follow up flight double bill, because if you haven't seen them, you could watch the Flaming Hot Cheetos movie combined with the Beanie Babies movie. Which
I was going to say the Tetris movie.
I was going to mention
that one was good.
I was going to say, has anyone seen Tetris?
I've heard it's good. That's next on this. Well,
it's got some surprisingly big swings.
Yeah. Yeah, I was going to say, wash it down with the Seinfeld Pop Tart movie.
That's the next two flights sorted.
Done. Yeah,
I'm ready. I'm ready to go.
Air in between, maybe.
Yeah.
Oh, you know what? I did see Air, and I would put Air below both Blackberry and Dumb Money. That's the annihilation of my ranking.
Air feels like a great
also about depression.
Plane movie as well. Not because it's called Air, because
I probably would have liked Air better on a plane than I did watching it at my house, I think. The other thing I've been watching, it's very obscure. I don't think anyone will have heard of it. It's practically brand new. It's the reality TV show Survivor.
Whoa.
Which has been a reality TV juggernaut since 2000. Well, somehow I had never.
It has on your side of the pond, Caroline.
I was going to say, it's weird.
You guys not watch.
It has gone through repeated like attempts to make it happen over here.
Oh, interesting. I just assumed at this point every single country had their own Survivor franchise that had been running for 27 years.
No, we have like two or three times it's been attempted, and every time it just. Like, I remember reading recently that they were bringing it back to the UK, and then Googled it, and it was like, oh no, it's had two series, and it's just it's just not made a cultural impact.
Interesting. Maybe you guys don't have the same like weird need to prove yourself in a survival.
I don't know.
Slash Alliance context.
Love Island, and
yeah,
and I guess I'm a Celebrity. British Get Me Out of Here is the different is like the is the UK version of it, which is I think just a bit a lot frothier and sillier.
Yeah. Well, I hadn't somehow in, never in my life, even though Survivor has been on for legitimately 40 seasons and 20, I think it started in 2000, so 24 years. Somehow I had never seen, I don't even think an episode in my life. And again, looking for comfort watches, watched, Googled, okay, non-spoiler, what's a good season to start with? Watched season 7, was hooked, watched season 6. Now I'm halfway through season 1, and there's a chance next time I come on this podcast, I will have watched all 40 seasons. I fully got sucked in, and we'll see how far this goes.
And they like, doesn't US Survivor, like, it regularly brings people back, and
yes,
it's like
all-star exactly.
seasons.
That motivated me because I really liked some of the people in season 7, and I saw they came back in an all-star season, but I was like, if I'm going to watch an all-star season, yeah. I got to watch some of the other people that are in this all-star season. So I've taken a real deep dive. Very incredibly entertaining show. Also feel, even though I didn't watch it when I was younger, I grew up in that early 2000s era of reality TV, so I feel quite nostalgic for just the tone and the vibe of how shows like that were made.
Yeah. Cool. Okay. Well, I'll wrap us up then. So what have I been watching? Do you know what? I actually wrote it down this time, guys. So I didn't forget. I watched The Big Chill this week.
Mm.
You guys familiar with The Big Chill? Anyone seen it?
Yeah.
Nope.
Yep.
Yep. Okay. Great, we've done the straw poll. The Big Chill is a movie where, like, a bunch of college friends reunite after one of their friends commits suicide. And it's kind of them in a big house for a weekend, kind of like having all trying to grapple with the death of their friend, but also kind of ruminating on how they've got to where they've each gotten to in their lives and the kind of relationships that they had with each other that were maybe at different intensities and different times in the past. And there's been, you know, like affairs and romantic entanglements, and it's got this, you know, great cast. So it's Tom Berenger, Glenn Close, Jeff Goldblum, William Hurt, Kevin Kline, Mary Kay Place, Meg Tilly, Joe Beth Williams are the kind of the main gang. And I kind of liked it, but also I was sat there thinking, this is a movie like A Star Is Born that we should be making every 20 years. And like not directly remaking, but doing the Star Is Born thing, which is like, what's the version of that that's interesting now? And like, you know, different characters, just like doing that. Like, and I'm sure there are other versions of The Big Chill, but I think we just turn it into a franchise. Do it now, and just like the big chill 2024, and let's have some people that would have been in college together in the early 2000s just and you know and get, you know, just get that all-star cast together, like say, oh, who wants an Oscar nomination, let's do it.
Sean William Scott, Jason
Chalamet.
Biggs.
Yes.
I just worry that a version of that today would just be a load of the shots of people just on sofas on their phones, not talking to each other.
Got no signal out in the cabin.
yeah, that's it.
Their own shit.
Yeah, you're out in the middle of nowhere. There's no signal. It's easy. I don't know what generation we're talking about. It's maybe.
I think it's. Isn't it like baby boomers?
Oh, for them, yeah, I think. I'm just
you're saying our generation.
Yeah,
what generation
who would,
now?
Who would, like which who would
I guess millennials, yeah, right? Because what are they like? Yeah.
But who would be your Kevin Klein?
Wow, Joe, it took me so long to process what you were trying to say.
who would be your Kevin Klein and Glenn Close now?
Yeah. So who are our millennial icons? Slightly
Gosling, Gyllenhaal,
over the hill.
Over the hill.
I think Gosling and Gyllenhaal might be a bit too young. Might be a little bit older than them.
Well, Gyllenhaal's 40,
I don't think
right?
so.
Oh, really?
The plot. Yeah. The plot says I have pulled it up on Wikipedia. It says it's 15 years.
Oh, if it's only 15 years
after
then, yeah,
college.
Yeah. I was thinking 20s.
But then mid to late 30s.
Yeah. Okay.
But
okay.
You might. The thing is, you probably would age it up now, right? Because 15 years after college.
Yeah.
In the 80s, felt you probably would do people in their like 40s to they get feel, the same
yeah,
vibe.
15 years out of college now, they're basically still students.
They're still, exactly.
They feel older and they feel like they've lived lives.
Yeah.
Still yeah. interns. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you could do Andrew Garfield to tie it into our...
Oh, yeah. I could
Jesse Eisenberg. You did a social network reunion.
Justin Timberlake, Rashida Jones, and Rooney Mara.
Exactly. Honestly, I would watch. Yeah, 10 out of 10.
Sounds good. So yeah, I watched The Big Chill. That was my main takeaway there. And then I thought, Caroline, basically I watched something recently and I am now trying to immerse myself in this world and understand it more and understand the phenomenon.
The Eras Tour?
Yeah. I am.
Wow. I'm literally wearing a Taylor Swift t-shirt right now. So you've come to
I am
going right
to be
place.
In, I think, for the at least the next decade in the Taylor Swift world. Because
great.
I watched the Eras Tour in like 4 sittings with my daughter.
Mm-hmm. It's long.
And she dug it. Like, now, every time we're in the car, what do you want to listen to? A fortnight ago, it was Trolls. Now mm-hmm. it is Taylor Swift. And I have, I would say, largely ignored Taylor Swift as a phenomenon until now. Like, I'm aware of who she is. I'm aware she's mm-hmm. the biggest person in the world. I'm aware she's in this completely fabricated relationship with Travis Kelce. And I reckon I probably like knew maybe 3 or 4 of her songs, and even you know wow. watching the concert, like I was.
I think
like,
my parents knew more than that, Joe. That's embarrassing for you.
Oh, burn!
I watched it with my parents, and we counted up how many songs they knew.
I think I was on like maybe 4 or 5, and there
yeah,
was
that
there
sounds
was,
right.
There was a couple where I was like, I maybe will give myself half a point of recognition here that. I think maybe I know the tune, or like when she's got to the chorus.
It had
like,
played in like I a bet that you were at.
I think I've
at
heard
some point.
This before. Yeah, but like when I was watching season 2 of The Bear, and there's an episode where the cousin's listening to a Taylor Swift song on the radio, and I was like, "Oh, this is quite catchy. I wonder what this is," and Googled it. And it was,
oh my god,
I'm pretty sure that's Love Story.
Story that's wow.
So I'm like completely, but also, and I'm now listening. I'm like, oh yeah, I quite yeah, like a nice poppy way. I like that one. I like that one. I like that one.
Which was your favorite era? Which is your favorite era of the 10 eras that she offered you?
I mean, that's real tricky to say. In that I can't. Remember
a single one of them.
What was in
just pick a number between 1 and 10.
Pick a costume. Do you have a costume that comes to mind when you're?
Well, so that was the thing that Evangeline loved the most. She loved that she was in a different costume for each era, and she went through to her playroom and got a different costume to watch each era.
Amazing.
Yeah, I liked
that foam.
I liked the vibe of the trippy tree nymph sequence.
Mm-hmm. Evermore in your yeah. Evermore era, Joe.
But I don't think I am. I think I'm more in the like. What songs do I like? I like Love Story. I like Antihero.
Sure.
And I can't remember the names of the other ones. But explain to, because the one thing that I did, and I gotta say, like the Eras Tour, I kind of felt the scale of it, but I think what it failed to capture for me is like, why is this person so wildly popular, beloved? Because I like, if anything, the thing that I took away from it was she was very like, everything was like, oh, you guys, I'm so grateful.
Yes.
You're amazing. This is all because of you. You let me do this thing. You let me be the artist I want to be. And I'm like, okay, so is that what it is? Is it just like she invites everyone in and she's managed to find some way to make kind of that feel intimate on an enormous scale?
I do think she is kind of a marketing and celebrity image making like genius, like that as much as anything else she does, I think is one of her greatest talents. And I do think she is very particular about the connection to the fans. Like that's always been her sort of like cornerstone. She would have these like parties where she would literally invite her super fans to her actual house to have early listening for her new album. And she would like personally make them cookies, which obviously is impactful for the people that are there, but I think more so is like this image of like, this could be me. Like I could be the one chosen for this hat she gives out in the middle of the show, or like she's speaking directly to me. She's really good at cultivating
that. Only if
that.
You're in the James seats, you've got to be in the James region to get the freebies.
Exactly. I think she's very good at cultivating that. I think she's also, for me, because I don't even feel like, I don't know, I got really sucked into the mania of all this, and I wouldn't have said before that, like, oh my God, I'm a massive Taylor Swift fan. But I think
I've heard that from a lot of people.
She, because she's been around for so long, I think she's had the opportunity to suck in people at different stages. Or if you're someone like me, who's basically the same age as her, like her music was always progressing with me. So when I was in high school, or like, you know, just graduated from high school, she was thinking about just graduating from high school. And then, you know, when I was in college, she was in her sort of like, I'm a new young woman phase. And then when she had her big 1989 to switch to pop, I'm a cool city girl. Like that was when I was living on my own in Chicago. Like she, if your life, either you lived it alongside her or you were younger and you had those albums for you as you hit, okay, I've had an adult relationship and a bad breakup and I can relate to that. Or I've hit these things. Like she can be very specific in her writing, but I think she is smart about writing to quite broad ideas about relationships as well. So it becomes very relatable for a very mass group of people. And then even the thing of like, everybody loves the, here's your four Hogwarts houses, which do you identify with? Here's your Enneagram types, which do you identify with? And this marketing genius of like, here's all my eras and I have all my costumes, and which costume's your favorite and which era is your era? Like, I think it's all tied in addition to very great, catchy songwriting. It's all that marketing and design and like beyond marketing, but like the theatrics of it. It's like Hadestown. It's like, here's this really compelling on stage experience that sucks you in. And yeah, she really puts it together very well.
Yeah. It's why I don't buy the Kelsey relationship, because it just feels too perfect that like in the year of your massive tour that is being filmed and is going on to Disney Plus, and here is this guy who's on the defending Super Bowl champions who you can start dating and basically get a slot in primetime every Sunday or every other Sunday for 3 months, which, if everything goes well, you can then be there in the Super Bowl and like visit, you know, like a part of the narrative of the Super Bowl, and suddenly tapping into the consciousness of an audience, which was me, right? Which was, I felt like I couldn't escape from Taylor Swift for the past 6 months, and that, you know, there was no intent to seek out Taylor Swift. And then when the movie came on Disney Plus, I was like, well, I guess I'm watching this with my daughter.
Yeah.
I guess that's happening.
But yeah, but isn't it, do you disagree that for me, that relationship is as sort of fake or artificial or for the cameras, for the media narrative, as any other celebrity couple is, as, you know, Timmy and Kylie, as we, you know, talked about earlier, as 100 years ago, you know, the sort of Hedda Hoppers would be writing up celebrity couples.
I guess some of them are real though. I just expect...
I think two things can be true at the same time. One, that it probably is true that very famous people, and Taylor Swift is maybe the most famous person in the whole world right now, maybe up there with the fucking Pope and Elon Musk and whatever. But like famous people, it must be impossible for them to relate to us normal fucking players. Mm-hmm. So they have to date other famous people. And Travis Kelce, obviously not as famous as she was then, and not now. But so that's true, that celebrities must just be attracted to dating other famous people, other celebrities. And the other thing that's true is that it can be good for both people's media coverage. It can be good for their careers, good for them to date the right people at the right times in their careers. Because Taylor Swift has, you know, dated famous people for most of her adult life. And often those famous people have fueled the music, and whether it's Joe Alwyn or Styles or
Tom Hiddleston.
Am I thinking of Matthew Healy, Ryan Hiddleston, Gyllenhaal. They're all part of the storyline, and they're all part of their reason that the fans engage, that it's a way that fans can engage in between album releases, right? That, I'll look at the tabloid images of her with her newest beau. It's all part of it, but the relationship can also be true, because how could she date an older person?
So that's the part I just don't think the relationship can also be true. Seems too perfect, but I could be wrong. But yeah, so anyway, I guess now I'm going to spend the next decade of my life listening to Taylor Swift songs and probably tracking all of these narratives closely because...
Welcome to the club. Yeah. You get sucked in and then you can't.
Evangeline will be doing...
The Eras Tour, like part two, when she's released 20 more albums. And
yeah.
But yeah, I find it funny, Joe, the start of that story was I played the Eras Tour to my 4-year-old daughter, and then she's been asking to put on the radio ever since. And then midway through, you were like, "Oh, I just don't really get why Taylor Swift is so popular." You have it right there. That's the answer.
I understand a lot of it, but I guess I want to understand, like, what is it that? So I understand the breadth of it. I understand how someone can get that famous, but why is she the most famous person in the world? I guess.
Are you going to try to go see the tour when it comes to London?
No, I believe that it also... Evangeline's too young anyway, but I believe that... Like, my sister's going to see her, but she's bought tickets in, like, Paris or something.
Yeah.
because it's just... It was that... That was so the one that she could get to. So it was like, it's easier to go to Paris than it is to try and get tickets to the London gig.
I think just ask James. James has got some tickets in the store, so just if you ask him, he can sort you out. It'll be fine.
but yeah, so I'm gonna just continue trying to figure it out. I knew you were trouble. That was... I'm just looking at my music now. That was the other one that I'm enjoying.
I saw the concert the night that Travis Kelce saw the concert at the... I was at the first Travis Kelce show.
Which one was that?
I can't. That was Kansas City night two. I can't vouch for the authenticity of the relationship, but I could say at the time I went with my sister and we were like, is there anyone famous here? And we looked it up. We're like, oh, some football player we've never heard of. We don't care. And then it turned out to be the number one narrative of the year. So
amazing.
I like to think I played a big role in all of it coming together.
I've remembered the missing element from the question around the level of her fame. So I was listening to an episode of the Bill Simmons podcast where he had Chuck Klosterman on. You know, Chuck Klosterman writes quite a lot about pop culture and, you know, tracking its effect through time. And he was saying that what's remarkable about her is that she's reached this level of fame, but she doesn't kind of have that one... She doesn't have one song that has completely taken over the culture. Like, she hasn't had that single song of the summer, or she doesn't have a song that 50 years from now will pop on the radio and people will go, like, straight away be singing along the words.
That's not true. She definitely does.
Well, that she's got some that are close, but not...
Shake It Off When Shake It Off came out, that was the most inescapable song.
Yeah, mate, that
might a solid like 2 years.
That might be the closest to it. But that was he was making the argument that that's probably the one thing that she is missing is this like indelible song that will be just. And what he was saying basically was he feels like it's a matter of time, but that it's not.
Interesting. That's an interesting perspective. Yeah. If anything, it's like she has too many hits.
Yeah.
Where you're not like, oh, this is the one that I associate her with her. But I think that take might be underestimating some of her.
Yeah. He was, but I guess.
But I also wonder. Yeah.
The point he was making was that you have some much less successful artist than Taylor Swift who will happen across that one song that is just, you know, immediately iconic, and that there are some big artists that have two or three, and then there are some big artists that like that don't have one. Massive bands that just never really had that one song that became defining.
It also, but it could be a feature, not a bug, that actually she.
Yeah.
The moment you have a song that is your defining song, your sound, your moment in time, your story, your voice, then everything you do after that, it doesn't compare any comparison. So actually, maybe it sort of works for her that you'll have probably a dozen different Swift fans, which the Eras Tour is almost designed around this idea that you'll have different people will have connected to the different eras, and really what that means is different lead singles from those albums, really, if you know the truth of it. And it might work for her to go, yeah, you know, maybe I've never written like a kind of a song that will be played in 100 years. Maybe she hasn't, that's fair. But maybe that's fine, because it means that then a new album can slightly set its own tape.
Mm. Yeah. I reject the premise of this.
I will have to dig it out, because he definitely made a much stronger case for it than I did, knowing her music, which I do
yeah,
not.
Yeah, but do we go? I mean, I don't know. I don't know much about Bill Simmons' fandom. Do we trust him as the defining
It's not Bill Simmons, it's Chuck Klosterman, who's much more...
Oh, I see.
Yeah, yeah. Simmons was arguing against, he thought she did.
I see.
I probably would think that Caroline's view on this is probably more valid versus two men in their 50s whose main thing is sports.
It is funny. It's like, let's ask a 13-year-old, any 13-year-old today, like, what's the defining song of the Rolling Stones? Well, they're probably not the right audience to be answering that question.
Well, I think you could ask the question about how many did the Rolling Stones have. That's it.
Sure.
Yeah. I think we've tapped out of what we've been watching. Apart from, we're going to hand over to Rhys and James.
Well, hang on.
Oh, no.
It's been an hour. I think let's me and Rhys do X-Men 97 on the Patreon.
Okay.
Some other time.
Okay.
Taylor and Travis was your news story of the week.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, let's move on to our main discussion, which is of, as you said, Caroline, Lin-Manuel Miranda's Tick, Tick, Boom. So you kind of gave us a brief intro for why you picked it. Why do you like it? Because I'm assuming you like it. Sometimes
I do like it.
Sometimes, you know, Rhys will say, "Just let's talk about Red," because it's a film he hasn't seen. But I'm assuming that this is something you have watched, liked, and wanted to talk about.
Yeah. Can I actually tell you guys? Can I tell you how I first watched it? Because I feel like this is an insane insight into the film critic. Like, I don't know, the weird things we end up doing. I had this memory of like staying up all night to watch and review this movie. And I thought, could that have been what happened? Because again, 2021 is a bit of a blur. Mm. So I searched through my emails. And indeed, what had happened was I couldn't make the press screening, but I was assigned to review it. So I reached out to Netflix for a link, which they got to me at 11 p.m. the night before it was coming out.
Right.
So I began this movie sometime after 11 p.m. And I looked up, I submitted my review at 7 a.m. the next day.
Wow.
So my up until now, actually, my one and only experience watching this movie was watching it some probably multiple times between the hours of 11 p.m. and 7 a.m.
So you
writing a positive review and
you submitting it.
I basically it was a little bit nerve-wracking to rewatch because I was like, I hope it holds up. It helped that I had the soundtrack. I pretty regularly listened to that. So it had felt a little more top of mind than it would have if it wasn't a musical that I could listen to the soundtrack of. So yeah, I really liked it then. And I think if anything, I liked it even more this time. It's like such an... It's an unusual kind of deep cut musical. I was familiar with the stage show called Tick, Tick, Boom well before the movie came out. It's kind of like a cult. It's a smaller musical, but in nerdy musical theater circles, it's like relatively well known.
Yeah.
And one of the student groups at my college put it on. It is like a the movie goes into this, but it's basically the show that the composer Jonathan Larson wrote as a sort of like one man rock monologue is what he called it, that where he wrote all these songs and we just kind of like had this night where he told people about his life and performed these songs. And then Jonathan Larson went on to write Rent and very sadly died right before Rent went into previews. And then, you know, because Rent was such a hit and there was so little of his material that was out there, people retroactively turned the one man Tick, Tick, Boom into a three person, like very kind of small cabaret style musical. So I was a little bit familiar with that. And I think if anything, Tick, Tick, Boom is sort of had been known as like, you know, the lesser Rent. Like it was the only thing we had. So people were interested in it, but it's not, you know, it's something Jonathan Larson made before his biggest creative success, not after. And I think what's so cool about the movie is that it takes the stage show, but expands it into being like firmly and explicitly this biography of Larson himself that I think really deepens what could just be a slightly myopic, you know, I'm about to be 30 year old artist and I'm having all these existential crises, which is a story, you know, that's relatable, but also has been seen a lot before. I think what the movie does is it gives all this framing device that takes that little relatable nugget and relates it so specifically to Larson's experience. And then thinking about how Lin-Manuel Miranda's experience as this like wunderkind musical theater composer parallels that, I just think it's like this perfect mix of director, creator, and source material and actor, and just comes together to this like really, really special little like gift to theater kids out there.
And is that's how you describe yourself, right?
Yeah, very much so. To the point where I actually am so curious what, you know, I know you guys all have elements of theater you like, but to me, this is such an insular theater like love letter. I'm fascinated by what like normal people kind of make of.
I'm definitely this very kind of you movie. Watching, like, who is that cameo? What's that in reference to?
I mean, it's like watching whatever some. I mean, Deadpool's a bad example, but you know, some like really sort of nerdy comic booky thing, and then what is someone who has a less deep connection to that, you know, getting out of it?
I mean, I think it's great. I don't know where do you guys sit on Tick, Tick, Boom?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I'm probably the of the three of us, of the three non-Caroline members of the group, I'm probably the I am the most theatery. I mean, I work in the theater now. I went to a sharing 2 weeks ago, like very similar to the thing that he invites them all to in this movie. So, and that's a bit different to when I saw that when the movie came out a couple of years ago. Like, I'm more of a theater sort of have a theater job than I did then. But I program a theater and we do musical theater. I do feel pretty involved in this world. But I loved it when it came out. I recalled rewatching it today that I had it in my top 10 list. Actually, I had it. It was my third favorite film of 2021. And I think I liked it even more today. Yeah, just some of the, you know, yeah, some of the Moondance diner reference, some of those faces, I won't recognize as much as you, Caroline, I'm sure. But the bones of what Rent means in the US musical theater kind of canon, I did know before this movie, before watching this a couple of years ago, and therefore Jonathan Larson's place in that and the sort of tragedy of therefore of the story in the movie. And I also love the way that the musicality of the music in this film speak, you know, talks to Rent and then talks to Lin-Manuel, to Hamilton, because, you know, you probably have, it probably goes, probably, Sondheim, Larson, Manuel Miranda, maybe, you know, in terms of like, these are the kind of, these are the guys in musical theatre. And then, you know, pre-Sondheim, there are other people, other names that I can't recall now, but, you know, so I love that in this movie and in the, you know, it is that connective tissue between those three specific guys, which again gives the tragedy even more resonance. But yeah, but also I think all of that, because the movie's doing a lot. It's basically like, it's a Rent prequel. It's an expanded adaptation of a sort of an unfinished musical. It's Lin-Manuel Miranda's first directorial debut. It's quite a avant-garde musical movie that's set. It's a period drama. It's doing so many things, but it feels so light on its feet. Which is so amazing, actually. It's how light it feels is really impressive. And then I think the one thing that felt different for this viewing for me was actually how good Andrew Garfield is in it, and how important, you know, I think the movie is really interesting without him in it, but he feels so central to some of that, to some of the lightness, to some of the, he just always feels like he's got the exact right tone in the scene. And that's even taking aside all the actual musical sequences, just the sort of, you know, just the non-musical sequences. He's just really going for it. He's so committed. He gets across so much of this guy, you know, because we don't get a lot of backstory of Larson. We obviously don't get a lot of front story. You know, he's this very important figure in American musical theater history, really. He is. And it doesn't really go into it in this movie, but you kind of get his genius.
Yeah.
Through the performance, even though he's playing a version of the character 5 years before that genius, anyone really sees the genius. No, I just, and then all well,
and also
so
a guy who's
I
a guy
it.
Who
it's great. Really
the
it.
Version of him that is presented here is a version who's like, his pursuit of that genius is kind of making him act like a bit of an asshole, and like he's got this tunnel vision and this
like great man. Like I love the scene where he's making a joke, but where he introduces himself as the future of musical theater. And it's like, he's joking, but he also does feel that way. Like he has great man syndrome. And he is. Yeah.
He's also right in the history of this stuff. He's right.
I think Garfield doesn't shy away from that side of it, but like retains, like you're still with this guy the whole way. You're like, yeah, you are important and you do need to do this thing. You need to pursue this, but there is that, you know, but you're still like, oh, but come on. But like,
right.
But also be a human being.
Well, that's part of the, like, I think that's part of the capturing of the theater experience too. It's like, there are all these like pretentious big personalities in theater, and you kind of like, you know, they can be very annoying and they can be very lovable, and they can have charm that goes a long way to sort of selling their frustrations. And I think the Garfield performance really captures that well.
I think the film as well just has this, I think it's kind of the perfect. It's what Lin-Manuel Miranda needed, I think, at this point of his career, because he was getting into that like omnipresent stage of his career where he felt kind of unavoidable, but and to the point that even if you liked him, it was maybe all becoming a little bit too much.
It was the Taylor Swift, the overexposed.
and
running the risk.
I think this was the same year as was this the same year as Encanto? So he had Encanto
and In the Heights,
and In the Heights, and he had a Sony musical that he was like Vivo. Yeah, and he'd done Mary Poppins.
Weirdly, kind of charming, by the way, Vivo.
Yeah, Vivo's okay. And I think as well, because of who he is and the distinctive voice that he has, all of the projects that he works on, he feels so present in. And, you know, like even in Moana, like you feel, which, you know, he was kind of working on, I think, pre his kind of like cultural ubiquity. But you feel, you know, like there's a song in the middle where he turns up and sings, and you're like, yeah, that feels like a bit too much. And this film, I think, is the perfect kind of outlet where he can do all of his stuff and he can have that nervous, that kind of nervy energy that I think exists in all his work that kind of propels it forward. But where he's not the dominant personality and the dominant voice in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's his movie, but it's in service of this other guy. And like, this does feel like a film that's about Jonathan Larson, and that really actually, like, Lynn wasn't the headline here. Yeah, it was his directorial debut, but it didn't feel as oppressive. And I think what
good call, because both Hamilton and In the Heights, he starred in the two big musicals he wrote for Broadway. So you're right that he did have this association of like always being the face of his projects in a way that musical theater composers do not always have.
And even when he's not in the In the Heights movie,
yeah,
it just feels it because the songs feel so much in his voice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He also does turn up in that movie quite a lot.
He does turn up in that movie quite a lot, whereas he has like a brief like couple of second cameo in this one, right?
Yeah, he's mm-hmm. very, he's in the kitchen, right? He's in there for like 2 seconds, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, James, you go. Where are you on Tick, Tick, Boom?
So I wasn't massively familiar with the story. I've never seen Rent, never
Was this,
heard
was
of
this your
Tick,
first
Tick,
watch,
Boom.
By the way?
This was my first watch, yeah.
Okay.
I really enjoyed it. I thought it was very, like you say, Andrew Garfield's performance was really charming and went a long way to making me, you know, get on side with this guy who could have been, like you say, one of those, you know, great man assholes. But, you know, he seemed really human and relatable. Mm-hmm. And I had a good time with it. My complaint, if you can call it that, is that knowing that this was about the guy who goes on to write Rent, I wanted the end of this movie to be like the halfway point. Like, I wanted to see, okay, you did your first thing, it took you 8 years and it flunked, but you've got the encouragement to keep going. What happens now? And like, mm-hmm. I know as an adaptation of a stage show, you know, that's not within the movie's remit. But I think I would have liked to have seen the next thing, you know, to get the complete picture of this guy.
Yeah. Mm.
Except you are, for me, you because you are seeing the next thing, like what he goes on to write after. Well, what's it called? What's the show within this show called Superbia? Right. That after Superbia, he writes Tick, Tick, Boom, which is then adapted into the thing that you see, and then he writes Rent after that, which I think a lot of the stuff with Michael and various scenes sort of spotted throughout this movie act as, and for me they are completely successful, act as essentially kind of prequel material for Rent. So I think for me it's kind of masterful how it actually connects the timeline that you see in this movie. So this is like early 90s, you know, before he's 30, Jonathan Larson, through to his death, Jonathan Larson, and the success and Rent success, you know, Rent launching and the success of Rent. I think you kind of get all of this within this adaptation of the middle thing he writes.
And I'm
that works for me.
I'm a little wary of approaching this too much like a biopic because I know it's it's already fictionalized, so it's already once removed, right? So I found the character compelling, and I wanted to know more about him rather than see an adaptation of a stage show that I wasn't aware of, if that makes sense.
Like, it's just that there's...
Sorry,
go ahead. Well, I just think it's a good point because it's like if you were just to have no source material and say, let's write a biography of Jonathan Larson, you would obviously never give Tick, Tick, Boom. And yet it is interesting that Tick, Tick, Boom is like what... There's just so many things about this story that are wild that like someone who did go on... You know, how many people have done a one-man show about being a struggling artist and then not gone on to be anyone famous, right? Like there's probably thousands of those that are out there in the world. So the fact that he wrote that and then he did go on to find success is wild. Secondly, the fact that, again, 9 times out of 10, or 9.9 times out of 10, somebody writing about, like, I'm so stressed about turning 30. Will I ever be a great artist? I don't have enough time, is sort of like this just like, you know, bullshit anxiety that then you get over. Except, and, you know, he died at 35. Like, he literally didn't have time. And obviously he didn't know that, but it gives this eerie, like, you know, sense to the thing. It's like he is around, he's telling everyone, I don't have enough time to get all these things done. And everyone's like, you're just being crazy. Like, you're fine. You have all the time in the world. And he literally didn't. And then the irony that he's living in this, you know, AIDS crisis era where so many of his friends are dying young. And there's this sense of like, okay, well, you're straight. You're not HIV positive. Like, you don't have these concerns about dying young in the same way.
He's got this,
And then privilege. But then so many of his friends, you know, so at least some of his friends who were HIV positive are still alive today. And like, you know, went on to outlive him. Like, it's just all of these, like, it's just such a wild, wild set of circumstances that led to the existence of this story the way it is, I think.
Even the title, right? You know, the Tick, Tick, Boom. He names that when he's alive. Talking to some inevitable sense of his time running out, I guess. And he was right. And then there's all the ticking clock motifs in I presume the original playtext as well, I guess.
Yeah, I think so.
That just adds it. It's just it's a gallows humor. It's an irony. It's a horrid kind of morbidity to it.
It lends the film itself as well this real push and pull. Like the whole film does feel like it has this ticking clock energy, right? That he has to write this song in time for the thing. And you're kind of whipped because even with just like, you know, it's what, like two lines of narration at the start. Like, I'm like James, I've never seen Rent in any form. Very passing knowledge of Jonathan Larson. Like, I know what Rent is. I know what it's about. But I didn't know the creator of Rent had died when I first watched this movie anyway. And you get those kind of like two lines of narration at the start, which are basically like Jonathan Larson won loads of Tonys, Pulitzer Prize, but he died the night before.
The day before.
It's for showing, and you do feel like there is this ticking clock in the movie where, yeah, you're right, there's that irony of like, it's this ticking clock that is counting down to this incredible success that he will have, but also his early death. And then you're kind of what that lends that dramatic tension with the Michael character and the girlfriend is this, I feel like a conflict as you're watching it where you're like, devote more time to these relationships, spend time with your friends, but no, you're right. You don't have time. You need to write these things. You need to get this stuff out into the world.
And what that's a lovely echo of as well is Hamilton. Why do I write like I'm running out of time? Right.
Definitely.
So that's all in there too. And you know, obviously Miranda's basing that on fucking Alexander Hamilton. But obviously seemingly is connecting with something in himself. And then he's connecting that with Larson, and it happened to him too. So that's all that, you know, to talk about, you know, sort of dramatic tension. That's all just adding another layer of dramatic tension.
I
don't know how you guys feel about the In the Heights movie, but I feel like something like this would be much more interesting than what we got there, which I feel like this is the Lin-Manuel Miranda we can give you. We know you would like a Hamilton movie, but it's not possible right now. That show still has lots of money to make.
I mean, I quite liked In the Heights, you know. Having not seen the stage show, I didn't hate the movie.
I think it's difficult to hate. It's just not very good. It's my
it's
take.
Not very bad, though. It's not bad. Like, if you want more Lin-Manuel Miranda, it's like, here's the methadone. Yeah. You know, I was happy enough with it. I watched it a couple of times. It's good. But equally, I think the thing that elevates this is what Reese was saying. It's got that like intertext of it. Like, you can sense the meaningfulness of it. It's not just here's a filmed musical that we did. It's like, here's what it actually means to people, and here's why it matters. I appreciated it on that level.
And I was thinking watching it today, you know, so there's the scene in the movie where Larson is watching Sunday in the Park with George on their little TV, which I think is maybe my favorite musical ever. Like, so that is clearly connected with Larson, connected with Miranda. And then you get the Sunday segment in the movie, which is the same with all of the musical theater people, you know, set at this diner, which has this great history of that
Moonshine
scene
Diner
within
yeah.
it. Yeah. And then I was thinking about, it wasn't when Sondheim died in New York, they did like Miranda mm-hmm. led that song from Sunday in the Park with George, Sunday, which is called the same, has the same title as the song in Tick Tick Boom, you know, sort of led that was the big kind of showstopper of their big vigil that they did. And then, yeah, you know, that's all. So Sondheim as well is a piece that's also he's more recently departed, but you know, that's it's all in there.
Well, and I think Sondheim really died like shortly after this movie came out. So that also was like lending a poignancy. Because he recorded the actual voicemail that you hear at the end. I think in real life, Sondheim was actually even more of a mentor to Larson than this movie. Like, this movie sort of is like, oh, they've had this nice little moment, but I think they actually had even more of a direct friendship and mentorship in real life. Mm. So, yeah, there's just so many little, I don't know, musical theater connections, and just the shot of in the big Sunday thing, which is so fun and filled with all the Broadway cameos, but like when Bernadette Peters herself shows up and then Andrew Garfield takes her hand and like this little bow he gives to her is just the sweetest, like true sensation of what it feels to be this person so immersed in the love of theater and the different generations of it. And these like icons that you look up to and then breaking into it and getting to interact with them and like remain, you know, keeping the specialness of that. It just all feels so encapsulated to me in these little moments that, again, I'm like, I don't know what the guy at the party who's like the finance bro, who's just like overwhelmed by anything. I don't know if that, you know, a real life version of that character, I don't know what they get out of this movie. But for me, it just feels like there's so many layers to it about art in general, but like the Broadway musical theater world in particular.
So the diner sequence is when I am the finance bro.
Yeah,
because
sure.
That's the one that just, I think, takes me out of his story for a minute, and it all becomes a little bit too
self-indulgent.
Yeah, self-indulgent. Yeah, yeah. And, it's the sequence that feels... short parallels to In the Heights, but like the most In the Heights in that it all feels a little bit digital sky, green screen, like these people all being kind of superimposed into a shot, whereas everything else feels quite real and vibrant, and you know, like I think the production design in this movie is really strong. Like it feels like it feels periods specific New York.
Ooh, and... I could have had a bit more 90s fashion. I was like, you're skating very close to modern here.
Well,
the jeans are too skinny.
Yeah, I went bigger jeans, bigger shirts, bigger blouses.
Okay, so tick for the production designer, cross for the costume designer. I'll take note of that on my spreadsheet.
Joe, I don't. No, you go ahead, Reese.
No, you go. Well, I quickly then. I just think the whole thing.
If I must.
The whole thing runs a really nice middle lane between is it 90s? Yes, but is it not? Is it too 90s? No. Is it too musical theatre? No. But it's still, you've got all the references there. You know, this was a Netflix production a few years ago, back when they were, you know, spending big money on sort of auteur led movies that they thought would win Oscars. Didn't happen in this case. It hasn't worked out generally for them. But
I got nom for Garfield.
Sure. I just think it feels very accessible for a adaptation of a musical theater thing that sort of nobody thinks is super. You know, wasn't Rent, right? And it's a period piece. And Andrew Garfield is not a particular notable a musical person. It runs right through the middle of, oh, this is accessible. This is kind of, most people are going to get something out of this, and then the people that are going to get a load out of this are going to get a load out of it.
Mm-hmm. I think
it's such a successful, interesting project.
It's such a relatable central conceit that even if you just take away the Jonathan Larson of it and the biopic and all of the Broadway stuff, then it's that La La Land story, basically,
yeah. Right? Yeah.
Which is
yeah.
at its core, how do I balance my kind of my professional ambitions with my, you know,
with life.
With life and with relationships and like.
And this film says, just cut them loose, let them go.
Yeah. I also think there's that even more so than just the like life versus passion. There's also just the like turning 30, I think is kind of scary for a lot of people or whatever age you choose that represents the like, where should I be now? What age were my parents? You know, what did my parents done by the age that I was? What had my idols done by the age I was? Like it's an indulgent fear in a lot of ways and like a silly fear, but it also is so relatable, right? Like the, what have I done by 30 thing? I think even if you're not in the arts at all, that can be quite a relatable feeling.
It comes up in Three Body Problem. They make the point there, like, you know, great physicists all contribute before they're 30. Where are we now?
Well,
yeah.
It all ties in.
I find it really relatable. You know, in my personal life, I made a decision about whether I wanted to, you know, pursue my career doing film journalism, which wasn't going to be very well paid, or whether I wanted to, you know, kind of do the Michael thing in this movie, which was, you know, just go and take a job which is going to pay you a little bit more and live that more comfortable life and accept that, you know, the thing that you're a bit more passionate about isn't going to be your life anymore. But it can still be something that you're connected to, but it's not going to be your life anymore. And that's, and you know,
you made the right choice.
think that.
Someone on the other side of it, I feel like you chose well.
So we'd all like to be Larson in that scene, you know, because basically Michael says to Larson, yeah, but I was nothing. You are a genius, you know, and Larson knows it. And I think that is most people are Michael in that conversation and make the Michael choice.
Yeah.
But most people who have made that choice wish they were Larson.
But I mean, he does wait tables for another 5 years.
Yeah.
And that's and never gets the
yeah.
Never
I mean,
gets
it's what he does his whole life. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Back to what you were saying before, Joe, about the like CGI-ness of it that pops up at times. I felt that too, and I was a little frustrated about it. And then I spent a lot of time this morning just like reading about the production of the movie, and I was a little more sympathetic when I was remembering like what peak COVID era filming was like. Yeah. Like they filmed this. They filmed, I think, like a handful of days, maybe like 5 or 6 days before the pandemic hit.
The pandemic shut
them down for obviously many months. That I think they went back to filming before we had a vaccine. They said that they literally like couldn't sing live on set because, you know, there's that thing of like singing transmits COVID stronger than speaking does. So they literally like weren't allowed to sing for safety reasons. And so just like thinking about the logistics of that, and they said they were very concerned that a lot of the people in those cameos are like older people, so keeping them safe. And once I remembered what a battle they were up against with the logistics of filming, and I read one thing that was talking about they wanted to do a lot more location shooting for locations that were sort of like iconic in Rent or iconic for that era, but they just couldn't make it happen. So a lot of those scenes were in the diner, and all of a sudden, like a lot of even just like little minor concerns I'd had, I was like, okay, I can contextualize that for what an insane moment in filmmaking this was and how impressive it is that they pulled it together as well as they did.
Yeah. I think that's to be honest, I don't have a problem with much of it outside of that sequence.
It's a little too glossy. I agree.
Yeah. Yeah, and
but seeing all those people, like, again, I totally get it. It's like, if this doesn't mean anything to you, it doesn't mean anything to you. But there's like three of the original cast members of Rent that are there, and it's like Adam Pascal and his like famous Roger pants that he wore, you know, or you know, probably the this little Skylar sister reunion from Hamilton is maybe the one that's more recognizable to to more broader, less in-depth theater fans. But
I think,
yeah, that kind of stuff is really fun.
Yeah, the Hamilton sisters and Bernadette Peters, I'm like, okay, I know who these people
are.
Yeah,
that's the fact that I recognize those ones made me go, everyone else in this scene is a cameo, but I just don't know who they are. Yeah.
It's actually in an even more extreme version of that you might not even have realized at all, but it's like a little flashback to when Larson is first getting positive notes from Sondheim at like a very early reading of Superbia, when Richard Kind is like giving the negative notes.
Yeah.
They say that he's at, he's like, oh, it was a workshop for up and coming songwriters. And they sort of quickly scan over the audience and then get to him. Every single person in that, who I think is supposed to be the other up and coming composer, is a massively famous musical theater composer. So like Lin is not just doing, let's do cameos of, you know, actors that maybe someone will recognize from some ABC procedural. This is like, let's get the 100 people are going to be like, oh my God, it's Jason Robert Brown who wrote The Last 5 Years. And like, I recognize his face, even though he himself is not an actor. So it definitely is like deep, deep, deep cuts, probably more so than most people would even realize.
All of those people, I was going to say all of those, he maybe feels like he wants to just put down the text of, hey, if you were a musical theater composer between the years of 1980 and 2020, this is I want to put down your experience, right? That this is not just about Larson, although it is. It's also because he knows it too, and he wants to try and connect up this whole, you know, this whole industry, this whole way of working across decades, to try and put down the text of, here's the text of this way of working. Which has a lovely ambition to it, for sure.
Can you guys talk to us a little bit about Rent and kind of why it was so...
Yes, we open Act 1, December 24th.
So I'm asking this question because I'm aware that the movie doesn't have like the best reputation as like being an amazing adaptation of the stage production. I'll probably watch the movie at some point, but I think my reticence has always been, do I want to watch the version that everyone's like,
They filmed I will describe Rent, but just off the bat, they filmed a like Rent live on Broadway. So like for people who are familiar with the Hamilton that they put on Disney Plus, they call that a pro shot. What it is, like a filmed version of a live production. Same thing they did with Sunday in the Park with George. And I believe Rent has a pro shot filmed live on Broadway that I think is probably a much better experience of Rent than the movie would be.
Okay. So I found it. I found it on Letterboxd and I'm going to add it to my watch list. And,
I'll also say that I don't know how, if there's any accessibility for this in the UK, but I think it was Fox or NBC did one of those Rent Live. They did all those live musicals for a while, and Rent was one of the ones they did. And that was the one where the poor guy playing Roger broke his foot, and they ended up airing the dress rehearsal because they couldn't do the show actually live, which overshadowed the production.
Hutchins play Maureen?
Yeah. She was Maureen.
Yeah.
I actually thought that was a really nice version of Rent too. They kind of, I really liked some of the adaptation choices they did. And the cast I think was mostly pretty strong. So those are the two versions of Rent I would recommend over the pretty not that good musical movie. But yeah, Rent is, so it's what was it, 95 when it opened, 96? It's a rock musical that was sort of a then contemporary story of a group of friends, and the whole plot is based on the Puccini opera La Boheme. So they sort of like, you know, Clueless style of like, we're taking Jane Austen's Emma, but putting it in an American high school. This was like, we're taking La Boheme and this bohemian story, and we're looking at the bohemians of the 1990s. So it's just like a year in the life of this group of friends. And I would say there's several different romantic storylines. The AIDS crisis is a major theme. There's four characters that are HIV positive, I think. And that's always like the joke, whatever, the world police like joke. This is a musical where everyone has AIDS, but whatever. That's part of the backdrop of it. A lot of it is about the conflict of that's in Tick, Tick, Boom of like, do you sell out? Do you follow your passion? Do I get a sleazy job as a filming tabloid news when I want to be an artistic filmmaker or whatever? So it's just sort of like this very Gen X rock musical that's encompassing, you know, for better or for worse, Jonathan Larson's perspective on what it was like to be an artist and a creative person, a bohemian in the 1990s.
And what tips it over into that kind of, you know, like totemic?
I was going to say, just to expand on that question, like, I'm aware musical theatre wise, there's a kind of before Rent and after Rent.
Mm.
Why is Rent the turning point? Like, what's the
I special? I think actually artistically, you could argue that Rent is a little less of like a full turning point and more a continuation of rock musicals like Hair or Tommy. Like, there had been a genre of rock musical before and they had been successful. I think Rent is probably the biggest like commercial hit of that genre to sort of like really normalize the idea that rock music can be musical theater music. Like, we can have an entirely different sound than the classic Hello Dolly, you know, golden age musical theater sound. I think artistically Rent is like a continuation of something that had been bubbling under the surface for a while. And I actually think probably its impact is like cultural and commercial as much as anything else, because it really popularizes this idea of musical theater as like a youth art form.
Mm.
And there were these huge, they would call themselves Rent heads. These are like the obsessive Rent fans who would like sleep outside the theater to get tickets and go see the show 100 times. And I believe that this is where they started the idea of rush tickets, which everyone, I think, Reese, was it you that said that you got rush tickets or something? Like, I think Rent in a lot of ways popularized or introduced that idea, and lotteries, and the idea of, you know, musical theater as this cool youth event, which again, you see so much in Hamilton, like that vibe. I think Rent was really one of the first shows that captured that feeling in this sort of big, commercially successful way. And then also it is a musical that is about AIDS. It does have multiple, you know, there's three main romances in the show and two of them are queer romances, right? And there's a lot of people of color in the show. And I think there's things to critique about like how much is Jonathan Larson understanding and conveying these experiences authentically. But on the other hand, you know, I don't know if that was the norm in the mid-90s to write musicals or to write anything really with like a bunch of queer people of color dealing with the concerns of the modern era, you know? So I think it's sort of like, it's changing the face of what Broadway can look and feel like. And at the same time, like the commercialization of it, like the success of it, I think is game changing in its own right. Were those helpful answers?
Yeah, that absolutely. Was exactly what I was asking.
And I guess easy then to draw the lines with Hamilton, because
I think Hamilton is a great, like, if you're just trying to put yourself in the mindset of like, why was Rent such a big deal or what did it feel like, I think Hamilton is a great comparison. Hamilton, I think, probably went broader just because culture can travel differently now. Like, I think probably a Broadway show in the 90s was never going to be as big as Hamilton could be in the 2000s, but I think the level just below that is like what Rent reached as this full cultural phenomenon.
I wonder whether the difference with Hamilton was Spotify, right? I heard so many people talking about Hamilton from it playing on Broadway, and then I could just listen to it on, and because it is one of, you know, it's a musical where the entire plot's in the music, I was like, oh, I can pretty much experience this.
And Rent is actually like that too. Most of Rent is sung through. So if you listen to just the score, you actually get quite a lot of the experience of the show. I would say.
Reese, were you?
I like Rent. I mean, I know it's just like, just to put it out there, it's one of those shows that some people are like, that's just not for me, or like, it is trying way too hard to do this, you know, progressive social thing, and like, that's just not for them at all. But personally, I have been and probably always will be a Rent defender.
Yeah, so so Caroline's covered almost all of it, but my Rent stuff is that I think after Tick Tick Boom, even though I knew these things, I'd never seen Rent live, and I'd never seen any of the film version. So after loving Tick Tick Boom originally a few years ago, I then watched the Rent movie, and then watched various clips from like recorded stuff, including that 2019 special Caroline with Hudgens as Maury. Mm-hmm. And I just found it so interesting how much connective tissue there was between Boom and Rent.
But definitely,
but you can just see, you know, you can kind of see why Rent hit so big. I think the musicality of it, the songs are just, they're just better. I don't know. They're just more developed. They're just more interesting. The lyricism is better. The musicality is better. And then today, after watching it again, boom. I went and watched for the first time about 45 minutes of the film live on Broadway Rent thing, which is available to borrow on iTunes. So that's my kind of Rent stuff. But, and I would love to, I mean, it probably is due a revival either here or in Broadway in the next 5 years. Yeah. Before. So we'll see.
It might be running off Broadway right now.
It's also worth saying, you know, sometimes these things, these moments in the culture are, you know, the stars that are linked to them are, is also a piece of it. So the original cast of Rent, you know, Rent broke Anthony Rapp, who was the lead, Jesse Martin, Idina Menzel, basically Rent was her breakout, and Taye Diggs. So that's a pretty box office, you know, initial cast, and then so many interesting people have then performed the various roles in the different versions since. So the one I just started to watch earlier, which basically was filmed. It was the final Broadway performance of Rent. So it was the end of that one, which was 2008. I guess they'd started in 96, so they'd 12 year run, and pretty much, you know, all the cast was different, but Renee Anise Goldberry, who of course is in Hamilton, one of the Scarlet Sisters, she plays Mimi, so she pops up, and then Vanessa Hutchins in Boom had played Mimi in 2010 in a version, and MJ Rodriguez, who's in
there's a version
so yeah.
I know that, was it the Hollywood Bowl? They've done, Neil Patrick Harris, I think, has played Mark. It is one of those shows where I think any musical theater performer at any point in their life, like the show just ran for so long, they did some sort of stint in it. For your just general PSA for your listeners, if you ever want to go, I don't know, some people are like, bootlegs are unethical, don't watch them. But I'm like, girl, watch a bootleg. Like, you don't need to go spend all this money on theater tickets. So just watch a bootleg. The terminology on YouTube isn't, because you'll get flagged if you say something's a bootleg. People have started calling them slime tutorials. So if you ever just literally type in Rent slime tutorial, there probably will be a million things that pop up. Watch whatever you want. Watch clips from these film productions.
Evangeline's gonna end up watching Rent
slime tutorial.
Yeah, because
and also like, just in general with musicals, like, I think also don't feel like you have to always go see, and this might be easier to do in the States, but like, it doesn't always have to be this big flashy West End production or something. Like, I, even at like universities, like theater universities that are doing shows, like those can be great productions that are obviously going to be way cheaper, or regional theaters. You know, I feel like I've probably seen Rent live more than any other show in my life. And only, I think, two of those times were on Broadway. Like, finding regional theaters, especially for these classic musicals, is such a great way to experience them without having to spend all that money on a Broadway or West End ticket.
So if I can just jump in then, on that point, there is a production of Rent starting this year, in fact, this summer, It's going to be at the New Theatre Peterborough and then the Queen Theatre Barnstaple and possibly transferring to London afterwards.
Amazing. But that let's all go.
That is very, very regional for the UK. But
yeah,
if it comes somewhere near me, I think I'll make the effort.
Sounds
I was going to make a... There's a poignancy, though, to Rent, and this movie is reflects it, which is that, again, if you compare to Sondheim, compared to Miranda, you know, Lin-Manuel Miranda still alive, still will make new work. It might not be as good as Hamilton, but, you know, he'll make it, probably, you know, assuming he sits around. And Sondheim made a, you know, was working from his mid-20s, has got a dearth of material out there. And each of them, you know, Sondheim, Miranda, and Larson have such a, Joe, you were talking earlier about Miranda's feeling so present in the work that he does, because his songwriting style is so specific. And I think all three share that. I think you know, you watch Tickety Boom, you watch Rent, and you can just see, oh, this is the same guy who's written these lyrics, written this music. Sondheim obviously is the same. Miranda is obviously the same. And but there's a sadness, there's a poignancy with the fact that Jonathan Larson, you know, he basically just made the one proper Broadway show, and it's Rent. And yes, we can dig up and expand Tick, Tick, Boom. We can, you know, I'm sure there's been Superbia. I'm sure there's been Superbias up and about.
Well, there's bits of Superbia in this, isn't there, as well?
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And that was an addition the movie, too. That was not... They do quite a bit of adaptation and expanding of the Tick, Tick, Boom source material. Like, I think they mention Superbia in the Tick, Tick, Boom stage show. But Lynn was the one who was like, I'm going to go into the archives, find these songs that had never really been heard from Superbia, and then stage them in the workshop that exists within this filmed version. So there was such a, like, there's such a care taken to how Lynn put the whole thing together. I think that the Jonathan Larson apartment that exists in the movie is like an exact 100% accurate replica of Jonathan Larson's real life apartment. Which is just like, they're just doing that for themselves. You know what I mean? Like that doesn't really matter to an audience member, but it's like, you can tell that they care so much that they're like, we're going to get every detail of this exactly right, down to exactly what this apartment
looks
like.
It's funny that you say that, because when he was in that apartment, I was thinking, I wonder if this is how he actually lived, or if this is like the romanticized movie version where he had his little Apple II or whatever it was.
Right. Maybe that, you know, maybe they expand the square footage to be able to fit the camera in there or whatever. But I think that they, I guess he had filmed some video like for insurance purposes. The real Jonathan Larson somehow had done this really extensive filmed tour of his apartment for some sort of insurance record. So they literally pulled that footage. And then, I mean, I think it sounds like this was just, it became an obsession of the production team, probably beyond what was really needed. But it was this walk-up apartment. It literally had no heat. Like they had, when they have the line about like, we have this illegal electric stove, will it explode on us? Like, I think that was true. This is also something that happens in Rent, but the buzzer wasn't open. Rent, so they would drop the key out the window to whoever was their friend that was standing on the front stoop. So their friend could catch it, and nobody had to go down all the flights of stairs to get the, you know, to let them in. So it is feeding into the like the real life Jonathan Larson, but then as you're saying, Reese, like it is that also then becomes a Rent sort of like origin story, because so much of Rent is pulled from at least some sort of, you know, imagined version of how Larson and his friends were living at the time. So it all like feeds into each other in this little like hodgepodge of
and there's a song in Boom of, there's this real life is kind of a song about how real life blurs into art. So he even was aware, he was kind of writing into the future back in the 90s about what we're talking about now.
I think it really benefits this movie as well, that in terms of its accessibility. I know for some people, right, there was just a barrier of musicals, they're basic, I cannot get into this genre. I think what this movie does really well with having the kind of the mix of the kind of the Tick, Tick, Boom performance, but then it kind of bleeding into him kind of performing some of it on the in the sets. And then also, you know, I think that song in the apartment is such an important like tone setter early on when they do all just burst out into song. And you're like, yeah, this just feels like something that these people would do. And so kind of think for the rest of the movie, whether you're experiencing them kind of, you know, him singing his, you know, the Superbia songs being performed, or the Tick Tick Boom framing musical, or the songs bleeding into the movie itself, like, it all just feels natural. It all just feels like the language of this movie and how it all flows.
I totally agree. And 2021 was the year where we got not only In the Heights, but also Dear Evan Hansen and West Side Story. That was like the big musical theater year. And I think really of all of those, like, I think I like how Tick, Tick, Boom handles the musical numbers the best, because exactly as you're saying, Joe, it's like, Lynn doesn't feel like I need to define the rules, and this is when it's a dream sequence, and this means this, and this means this, and here's exactly how we can operate. It's just like, it is what it is. Sometimes it feels like it's a little bit of a dream sequence, but we're not going to overthink it. We're just going to
embrace let everything the theatricality be fluid.
Exactly. And I think that's such a nice way to present musicals. Like, I think genuinely the musical numbers in this are so well staged and well done, and they're just like a joy to watch. And that, again, I think it's like, maybe you wouldn't expect that of Lin-Manuel Miranda, because he comes from the composing world and the performing world, but I think he has such an understanding of musical theater, and then clearly probably such a love for movie musicals, that he's really able to combine it all in this really, like, I think more seamlessly than In the Heights does. Tick, Tick, Boom is able to switch from dialogue scenes to the musical numbers in a way that never feels distracting and always feels seamless.
Yeah.
There's the one in the party that I felt that the most about, which I thought was so kind of just so masterful. Like, you know, it's he starts to bang the drum to make the rhythm, and then I can't remember the song now, but
yeah, this is
it's
the
like
life,
a proper musical number. And then the characters are talking about stuff that like their own life, but they're also seemingly still in the party. But it's this, you wouldn't quite say, oh, that's a song they're all singing within the text of the party that's happening in the movie, or this is a musical sequence that's happening outside of the reality of the film. It's totally in the middle, and the movie doesn't care to make you choose. It's that's such a casualness to that is very lovely, really, really, really great.
My favorite is the one called No More, which is the one that they sing when they go to Michael's new apartment. And there's, you know, we're not going to have to carry our laundry. Yeah. We're not going to have to freeze to death, whatever.
Yeah.
It's so, that's probably the, like, I guess other than the Sunday in the Park homage, but I think No More is like the showiest musical number. Like, it's, you get these like really washed out scenes of the two of them singing in their gross old apartment, and then them dancing around the nice new apartment. And then it becomes this like slow-mo fantasy sequence of them in the tuxedos and all the gold around. And it's quite a music video effect, but they do that thing where everything's moving in slow motion, but they're lip syncing correctly. So clearly they were, you know, were doing it faster when they actually did it to make it all match.
And you just reminded really me with the music video that there is literally a music video in this movie.
Yeah. The rap number.
Yeah.
Oh, that was so good. I love that.
It's so cute. And then the footage, you see the footage at the end of
Larson doing it on the stage in the cap. And yeah.
So funny. My favorite part of that, and my favorite probably moment in the entire movie, is when the guy finishes and then he's in line for the Cat's audition and he's just like, I'd like to read for the role of Old Deuteronomy.
Reminds me of
I had to pause it. I was laughing so hard.
Reminded me of Kimmy Schmidt that did.
Yeah, oh my god.
Yeah,
the Kimmy Schmidt Cats storyline is the single funniest thing I've ever seen in my life, I think. Love that. And the therapy number, like, Garfield's great, but like the supporting cast here is so good. Like Vanessa Hudgens kills that therapy number. Mm. She's so good in it.
So I wanted to go through the rest of the cast. We'll probably draw this to a close soon, but So we got on stage, we've got Vanessa Hudgens and
Joshua Henry.
Yeah.
Who's a Broadway guy.
And they kind of, I guess they feel quite, like I was almost surprised that like Vanessa Hudgens, who's probably the second most famous actor in the movie. It's quite like how recessive a role it is, but she just lets her pipes do the work, right? She's that good.
Yeah, she really pops. I agree with you that I could have used more of her, but she's very impactful in what she's in.
And then I guess the two kind of key ones in the main narrative of the movie, there's Alexandra Shipp as Susan, who's his girlfriend, at least at the start of the movie, and then is it Robin de Jesus as Michael? Yeah. Who
he's a long time he was in the original cast of In the Heights. He's a long time Lynn collaborator. Yeah. And also theater deep cut, there's this like early 2000s movie called Camp.
I wanted to talk to you about Camp.
Have you seen Camp?
So I hadn't seen Camp when this came out, but it'd been on my radar for a long time, was this movie, and watched it on DVD recently, and he's like the lead, right? Basically.
Yeah. Or definitely one of the features. It's like a young adult theater camp,
which
a very campy movie in and of itself.
And I think with Theater Camp coming out last year, it's definitely a good movie to watch coming out of that. But he's great.
Young Anna Kendrick.
Well, that's it. I think that's what it's probably most famous for. Anna Kendrick, who's in it for like two or three scenes, but just like walks away with the movie. Yeah,
exactly. Sweet Little Baby, Robin de Jesus, when he's like his little dorky, I actually haven't seen it in a while, but it's like a trio of leads, right? It's like it's Robin sort of the point of view character, then a girl, then like a really flirty guy who no one can figure out if they're gay or straight.
Yeah, but he's got very like generic white dude energy.
Mm-hmm.
And he's kind of the least interesting of the three of them. So I kind of enjoyed rewatching this now, knowing him from that, rather than all the other success that he's gone on to in his career.
I'm right. Like,
oh, now I've seen the kid from Camp is in, yeah. And I was like, oh, I think I've got a lot more out of his performance this time around.
It's a cornerstone. It's like a sleepover classic amongst the theater kid set. But I think Robin de Jesus is great in this movie. Like really, really good.
Yeah. What do you guys think about Alexandra Shipp? She's maybe the weakest link for me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She's like, I kind of always feel this way about her. She's kind of like a neutral. Like I would never be like, oh, I've never seen her in something and been like, oh, she was bad or like she dragged this down. But I feel like infrequently am like, oh, she added a lot to something. Like she's just kind of there, which I think is mostly how she is here. I don't think she has great chemistry with Garfield. No. I don't think she really reads as a dancer. And those are like her two, the two things required of the role. Yeah. I do think she kind of nails the final breakup scene or like post breakup scene where they're outside at his birthday party and she gives him the blank thing of music.
It's such a great
And I was concept. Like, that's a good
the scene. Just that.
The scene is good and she's good in it.
You're so right about her though, Caroline. I'm scrolling down her IMDb and going like, oh yeah, she was in that and she was in that and she was in that. And a bunch of stuff that I'm like, yeah, I didn't dislike her in that, but I'd kind of forgotten she was in it. I kind of forgotten she was in Barbie.
Sure. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I think there's also this slightly weird thing where Garfield and De Jesus are like they're too old for this role, right? Like they're supposed to be turning 30 and both of those are they're closer to turning 40.
Yeah.
And they cast Shipp, who is, I think, the right age, but probably they cast it that way because they're like, okay, somebody in this cast should be a little bit younger to sort of age down the boys, but I think that's hurting the chemistry a little bit because they don't quite feel like they match together as well as a different actor might.
Yeah,
I think the material is slightly to blame. Like she's a very thinly drawn character. We don't see a lot of her.
Yeah,
you know, we don't see a lot of anyone outside of when they're interacting with Andrew Garfield. But you know, I think she does as much as she could with what she's got. If the chemistry isn't there, there's not much you can do to fix that. That's on the director, not her.
But you wonder what, like, if Issa Rae was in that role instead, what, you know, I'm just picking somebody that, you know.
Yeah, I mean, there are definitely better versions of that character. It's just that, you know, all she's got to work with is chemistry. And if that's not on,
Yeah.
It's tough to come back from that.
Can I tell you guys the single funniest, sometimes when you're reviewing something, they'll give you specific spoilers that they would like you to avoid. You know, they'll say don't spoil the film, but in particular, yeah, we want to keep X, Y, and Z secret.
Yeah.
The ones for Tick, Tick, Boom, they were like, don't spoil all of the cameos in the Sunday sequence. I was like, fair, that makes sense. That is a big buzzy thing that you'd want to be a surprise. The other thing, and I want, as three people who are not familiar with Tick, Tick, Boom, I'm curious if this would have ruined your experience of the film if you had read it in a review. They specifically said, don't spoil the fact that Come to Your Senses is a duet. Now, here's what I have to ask you guys. If you had read a review and someone said, and they've transformed Come to Your Senses to a duet, would you have said, well, there's no point in seeing this film now. I've been spoiled on this.
Even having seen it.
It was the funniest. I was like, this must be a Lin anxiety that he was like, people can't know. And it was just so funny. It's the big climactic, that Hudgens and Ship sing together. And there could be a version of this material where you're just watching Hudgens sing it within the world of the workshop, but the movie makes the artistic choice that Larson is going to process this song he's written, suddenly realizing it applies to his romantic relationship, and he's imagining his girlfriend singing it. I think it's a perfectly fine choice. It's nice, but like the idea that this was some major twist of the material that no one could have known about in a review was so funny to me, and I remembered it all these years later because I thought it was such a cute little, specific musical theater touch.
I think we also need to shout out Bradley Whitford at Sondheim, who is so good.
I mean, really good.
He just if you just told me that going in, I'd be like, how's that? But he just like. I think there's like a double take where you're like, is that Sondheim? No, it's not Sondheim. Who is that? I know that. It's Bradley Whitford. He's great. And I also think that Judith Light absolutely crushes her kind of two scenes.
She really does. Especially that scene where she like just has to let him down very frankly and kind of be like, say the show was, it's not that the show didn't have potential, but it's not going to happen. You have to move on to the next thing. And you will be okay. Like she really plays that well.
Yeah. I love the moment where she walks in and she doesn't know who he is.
Yeah.
She plays that so well.
Yeah.
The thing I liked about that moment was when she takes the phone off speaker and like picks up the handset.
Yes.
So that she can talk to him like directly, and you get this sort of sense of like artifice dropping.
Yeah.
That was really nice.
It's really nice. And it's like a good, I think it's like a nicely honest scene, and in a way maybe speaks to, you lose something by this is not a full biography where we see the success of Rent happen. But I think that also allows it to kind of stand on its own as a piece about failure. Like this is about a guy putting on a workshop that he thinks is going to make him the next big thing, and it doesn't. And that feels like it's going to be the worst thing he's ever experienced, but it's essentially about him getting past that and being okay anyway. And there's sort of like quite a power to that scene where he just has to kind of like come to terms with all that, and she embodies that really well, as does Whitford as the Sondheim. This was a well-known story when this movie came out, but the final voicemail is actually recorded by the real Sondheim, as I think it is in the stage show. Actually, I was trying to figure out when that was, if that was always the tradition to do Tick, Tick, Boom with like a real Sondheim clip that I guess maybe comes with the material. But I guess the way the voicemail had originally been recorded was slightly more like flowery or positive, like the writing of it. And Lin showed Sondheim the cut or something. And Sondheim was like, yeah, it was all great. But like, I wouldn't have said it that way. Like I wouldn't have said like, you're the future kid or whatever they had him say. And he was like, can I redo it as I would actually have said it? Amazing. And so they have the real Sondheim do that little voice. Really, and it's just, I mean, I start sobbing at that part and just like don't stop through the rest of the end of the movie.
So I said, you get this from Sondheim, and then you get his little glass onion cameo the year after as well. Very nice little capo. And as well, as you saying, like the kind of the same season as West Side Story was remade as well. Yeah.
Oh, he also in an interview I read today, Lynn was like, oh, we've cast Bradley Whitford to play you. And Sondheim said, I don't know who that is, but he has a name that sounds like it's from a Jane Austen novel. So I love it. Which I thought was an incredible Sondheim moment.
Amazing. One final point. I don't know if this is apocryphal, but am I right in thinking that Garfield just basically hadn't sung before this movie?
I believe so. I think
Which
that they
is
put
crazy
him through.
Because he's great.
He is really good. I think they
and
put
also
him
he's
through.
He's got such that energy that you're like, no, you've been singing since you were 13, right?
Mm-hmm. He had done theater. I think he did this right on the heels of a really successful Angels in America run that maybe started in the West End and then he did again on Broadway and I think won a Tony for. So he had had the theater experience, but I don't think he'd sung. I think they put him through kind of an intense boot camp of learning to sing, but
it
paid off far more than,
yeah.
You know, I, someone who really finds La La Land difficult because I'm like, these actors can't sing. Like, I do not have that concern here. I think Garfield really nails it.
Well, that's what I like about La La Land. I like how shaggy it is.
I think that Garfield also has a voice that there's a flatness to it that you don't hear in Henry's and Hudgens' voice. He kind of does read as, oh, this is the guy that wouldn't then take the lead role.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike Lynn, maybe.
Yeah.
Or maybe Lynn also wouldn't take the lead role if it was a singing piece. But he kind of, it reads as, this guy's got a good enough voice, but not so good that he'd be in the show.
No, yeah.
Wouldn't.
You can watch pretty significant chunks of the original Jonathan Larson performance, like when it was a rock monologue. I was doing that before I watched, and Larson has such a particular energy, and exactly as you're saying, Reese, like he's not up there like I am the Ben Platt beautiful musical theater voice. It's like it's all a performance that's really charismatic, and I think that gives Garfield a lot of leeway to sort of lean into the characterization of it as much as the, you know, the singing of it.
So anyone have any final points on Tick, Tick, Boom?
I kind of feel like Garfield should have won the Oscar. I forget who was nominated, but I feel like he's so good.
Who did win that year? I'm just looking at my spreadsheet. So I have Garfield nominated. My winner would have been Benedict Cumberbatch in Power of the Dog, who I think is...
Oh.
I just... think he's so good in that.
Oh my god, do you guys know who won this year?
Someone bad, right?
Will Smith.
Oh, this right, of course.
Slap Oscar. Yeah. So in a world where Garfield wins, Will Smith's career is looking very differently right now. That's wild to imagine.
My nominees this year, I've got Simon Rex for Red Rocket, Hidetaki Nakajima for Drive My Car, Nicolas Cage for Pig, Garfield and Cumberbatch.
Yeah.
It's a good five.
Yeah.
But yeah, Garfield's amazing. And it felt like there could have been a narrative around Spider-Man as well, right? That here is a guy who is in the movie that is just eating up the box office. Kind of the first movie that's done that. Can we celebrate him?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because that's a nice way to tie it into your original podcast purview. Yeah. Is that all those interviews where everyone was like making Garfield confess that he was in Spider-Man when that was like the semi-open secret? Those were all interviews for Tick, Tick, Boom. Like he was the one, he had to deal with all that because he was the one doing press for a big buzzy.
Yeah.
Award season movie right as all the rumors came out. So like not only did this movie give us a great performance and a great movie, it gave us the joy of just watching Andrew Garfield struggle to answer all of these questions on late night talk shows.
And it's his Tammy Faye year as well. He's good in that. And that ended up winning Best Actress. So yeah, you could definitely see a narrative, but obviously you can't. The Will Smith juggernaut that year was...
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, that works out well for everyone.
No issues at all.
Okay, so that was Tick, Tick, Boom. Caroline, thank you so much for joining us and for suggesting that movie. I think great discussion.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for letting me wax poetically, maybe semi-deliriously and incoherently about musical theater, as I like to do on the end of a week-long illness when I haven't spoken to someone in a week. I love to just rant about musical theater.
Definitely just incoherently, but everything else, yeah. You're
I just asked Caroline a question on like any musical theater recommendations for now. Ooh, yeah. On the US, like what's good?
Good question. I think a lot of stuff is just about to open on Broadway. If you are one of those people who likes to keep up with the Broadway season, there's a new Great Gatsby adaptation. I don't know. I haven't seen it and I haven't heard the music, so I can't say if it's good or bad, but it stars Jeremy Jordan, who's a big musical theater guy, and then Eva Noblezada, who you might have actually seen in Hadestown if you saw, or one of you might have seen if you saw an original cast. She was the original Eurydice. And I'm very much looking forward to seeing, I mean, I don't know if I'll actually be able to see the show, but just sort of like hearing it and seeing what it ends up being like, because I like those actors so much.
Caroline, you of all people should know, you can simply say Supergirl star Jeremy Jordan.
Of course. Supergirl's a star. Jeremy Jordan. Wow, I totally forgot that he has that Supergirl win. Win Scott, that was his character, right?
Yeah. And he's in the not very good adaptation of the last 5 years.
Exactly. Also, the Newsies Pro Shot on Disney Plus, if you need something to go right into.
Yeah, I saw a live version of that.
He's in that video of, you know, when they're the kind of viral video of Hugh Jackman when he'd been diagnosed with skin cancer on his nose, and he's performing The Greatest Showman, but he's not allowed
Jeremy
to do
Jordan the is the one that was supposed to be singing for, I think he sang for Hugh
all the way through, and there's like Cynthia Erivo's on the at the side as well doing a bit, and then Hugh takes over. It's great.
Oh, speaking of Cynthia Erivo, although she's not in it, but I thought the Color Purple musical that came out last year was not like this massive, I don't know, not the best thing I'd ever seen, but like super entertaining. And I think worth a watch just for the cast. Like, if particularly if it's something you just can stream at home, I think it's worth checking out. Strong cast, good costume design, not the best adaptation, but like you'll have an entertaining time watching it.
Excellent.
Just quickly, if you're coming to London, go see Operation Mincemeat.
Oh, okay. They made a movie of that, didn't they?
It's the similar story, but it is a kind of Armageddon Deep Impact situation where you had
two
people doing the same story. But
Is it a musical or a play?
It's a musical. It's a comedy musical, but it's really like... I don't want to say it transcends comedy, but it's got some good empathy in it as well. I've seen it twice and I really recommend
James, it. James, great. Where do you see it the first time you saw it in London? Remind me.
I can't remember. I saw it somewhere in South London the first time. Riverside Studios.
Okay. Riversidestudios.co.uk. That's the theatre I work.
It's currently on at the Fortune Theatre.
Yes, forget that. Come see stuff at Riverside Studios. Your listeners, yes, please, come on down. Jeep tickets, yeah.
Okay, final order of business before we wrap the episode. We need to talk about what we're talking about on the next episode.
It's your choice.
It's my choice. And now for my first choice, I picked Poor Things, basically, because I went... Hey guys, I've got this idea for the new format for the podcast, and you guys went, yeah, let's do it now. So we did it. We did it that day. We just announced that's what we're doing, and I was like, we're going to see Poor Things at the cinema this week. Should we do that? Went, yeah. So this time I thought, well, I just really need to. I really need to take this opportunity to really dial in on my bullshit. So we're going back to 1934.
I knew this would happen.
It's one of your old pornos, Joe.
Stop saying that.
But it's just like a woman like lifting up the corner of her skirt.
We are watching a movie that I think is going to be... certainly the trailers for Challengers remind me a lot of this movie. It is the Ernst Lubitsch 1934 movie Design for Living, which rules... There's a Criterion out there if anyone wants to invest in the Criterion. If not, it is rentable on Amazon. I will say to everyone, don't worry when they start talking and the first scene is in French and there are no subtitles. That's meant to happen. Definitely don't stop watching. Contact Amazon. Demand your money back. Then realize there's nothing else streaming, so procure a disc off eBay, start watching that disc and going, wait, this disc is in French as well? And then get a little bit further in the scene and realize, no, it's just that 30 seconds. So I owe my apologies to the Amazon customer service person for when I watched this movie for the first time last year. It rules. I really like it. So yeah, Design for Living, I thought it ties in quite nicely with Challengers from the vibe I get from the trailers for that movie anyway. So
is it about
based on a Noel Coward play? That's a fun time.
It's I love it. I really, really love it. Well, I watched all of the Lubitsch movies last year, and also all of his talkies and a few of his silent movies. And this was one of my favorites. So.
And just to clarify, is it about what if tennis and there was like a multi-snog? Is that what this is about?
I think the multi-snog part, yes. The tennis part, no.
Yes, less tennis.
Halfway there. Fine.
So, yeah, Design for Living on our next episode. And I think, Reese and James, you're going to do some X-Men 97 over on the Patreon. Is that right?
At some point we will, yeah.
Yeah. Exciting times. Okay, Caroline, thanks again for joining us. Listeners, thanks for listening. And all that remains to be said is goodbye, podcast.
Goodbye, podcast.
Goodbye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Kayla Itzinas.
I'm Kayla Itzinas, and I have been training a global community of women since 2009. I've created a brand new podcast, Sweat Daily, to help you level up your life and reach your health and well-being goals. From fitness tips to food that fuels you, meditation to motivation, we've got you covered. Sweat Daily, the happiest, healthiest, and most confident version of you awaits. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.